Bill Federer, Merry Christmas to you and your family.
Hey, Brandon, Greg, Merry Christmas to you, Melissa, and Logan, and your family.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Glad you're here. Although I bet you're having a little bit warmer weather down where you are.
Right, we're down in Florida, so it's always nice. Flowers year-round.
Supposed to be flowers year-round. It's supposed to be 75 and sunny here in the Mid-South on Christmas Day.
There you go. That sounds great.
That's not bad.
No.
And I think a lot of our listeners up in the Midwest are not going to have at least Minneapolis, Milwaukee. I don't think they've got snow in the ground up there right now. I think most of it's melted. I think they had a big snow in Minneapolis, but I hear it melted. I know the folks in Milwaukee said they didn't have snow on the ground when I talked to them the other day. So yeah, I think it's going to be a pretty mild weather pattern for most of us. All right, let's talk about your new book here, or this book you wrote. There really is a Santa Claus, The History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions by Bill Federer. We got a bunch of PowerPoint slides here, Bill. Tell us about this book. When did you write this, by the way?
Well, years ago, but we've re-edited it over the years and added more stuff to it. It's a fun book. And St. Nicholas is the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. So he is to the Greek Orthodox what St. Peter is to Roman Catholics. And so I put all the different stories together and how it sort of morphed into what we have today. And along with all the other Christmas traditions, one of them is the dating of Christmas. People aren't familiar with that. And if you like, I can jump into that.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, I don't know if I need to follow these slides or any of this stuff here.
Right. Well, the first 3 centuries of Christianity, it was 10 major persecutions. Christians were thrown to the lions. But the Jews did not celebrate birthdays. The Greeks did, but not the Jews. Matter of fact, we visited years ago in Turkey. My wife asked the woman we were staying with when her birthday was. She had to go in the next room, dig through some papers, and came out. Oh, it's in August. And my son worked in South Korea for a while. Everybody in the country turns a year older on January 1st, right? They don't keep track of their personal. So it was only when the Greeks began to convert to Christianity in large numbers when there was an interest in the birthday of Christ. Prior to that, the main day they were concerned of was the day of Passover. And so we pick up with the story of Luke, where it says, in the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zacharias who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. It's John the Baptist's dad. He's in the temple. Angel appears to him, tells him to have a son, name him John. And he doesn't believe it, so he's struck dumb. But then he goes home and his wife Elizabeth gets pregnant. Well, we read that. It says the priestly division of Abijah. That really doesn't mean much to us until we go back and realize it's King David who broke the Levites into 24 divisions or family groups. And each group took a week twice a year taking care of the temple and offering sacrifices, burning incense, and so forth. But we don't know where Abijah fits in because it doesn't say in the Bible the order. It just says David broke him into these groups, Solomon put him into service. Well, it wasn't until 1947 when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered that in there was the sacerdotal rota system. It's the order of the priests, the 24 family groups, Abijah is number 8, and Jehoiarib is number 1. Now, why is that significant? The Temple of Jerusalem is destroyed either end of July, beginning of August in 70 AD. Josephus writes a very detailed record, and he mentions that the priestly division of Jehoiarib is on duty when the temple's being burnt. And so if Jehoiarib is the first family and Abijah's the 8th ones, we can count from 8 weeks after the end of July, beginning of August, you basically get to the last week of September. And this is an important week in the Jewish calendar. This is the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles, which would explain why there were people waiting outside for Zechariah to come out of the temple. And so September 23rd in the Eastern Orthodox tradition is the date of the conception of John the Baptist, the forerunner of Christ. And so now we pick up with the gospel. And it says the angel appears to Mary and tells her she's going to conceive of the Holy Spirit. And then says, your cousin Elizabeth is in her 6th month. Well, if John the Baptist was conceived the end of September, 6 months later is the end of March. So March 25th is the traditional date for the Annunciation, when the angel announced to Mary and she conceived. And so if March 25th is the date that Mary conceives, 9 months later is December 25th, right? So we actually have some legitimate timeline, but we didn't have the last piece of the puzzle till the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947. So whenever you read commentaries prior to 1947, they don't have that sacerdotal rota system, and they weren't able to figure this out. But that's one interesting thing that's in the book. Another is that Caesar Augustus was the emperor of the world. He was a dictator, and he wanted to have a worldwide tracking system called the census. If he could have had 5G and satellites and people's Google searches, he would have kept track of all that, right? But something about world dictators want to count everybody and track them. And so Mary and Joseph have to go to Bethlehem to be counted, and that's when Jesus was born, fulfilling prophecy. So God still got his plan behind the plan. And then we have the three wise men come and visit, and it's called Epiphany. And so this is when Jesus is revealed to the world. So I do throw in the book, the gospel. So God is a just God, which means he has to judge every sin. If God does not judge a sin, his silence is effectively giving consent to sin. In common law, it's called the rule of tacit admission. And you've seen it in weddings, where the pastor says, anybody against this wedding, speak now or forever hold your peace. If you're at the wedding holding your peace, your silence is giving consent to the wedding. If there are sins going on and God is silent, his silence is giving consent to the sin. And if God gives consent to sin, he's no longer a just God. He denies his just nature. He denies himself. And he is not going to deny himself, so he has to judge every sin. But he's a loving God in that he provided the Lamb to take the judgment for the sin. So he's completely just, and then he judges every sin. He's completely love, and he provides the Lamb to take the judgment. And so Abraham and Isaac are going to the top of Mount Moriah. Isaac says, Father, we have the wood for the sacrifice. We have the coals for the sacrifice, but where's the sacrifice? And Abraham says, Son, God will provide himself a sacrifice. And that's the prophetic interpretation that Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, the only begotten Son of God, became the sacrifice, right? And so he took the judgment for all of our sins. And so we approach this all-perfect, almighty, just God without any consciousness of sin and any fear of judgment because Jesus took it all in our place. And so Mark 10:45, Jesus said, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. So I wanted to put that in there. Excellent. So the church is born into a one-world anti-Christian government, the Roman Empire. There are 10 major persecutions. Christians are thrown to the lions. 11 of the 12 apostles are martyred. And the worst persecution is Diocletian. He had lost some battles with Persia. He asked his generals why. And the general said, well, the army has neglected worshiping the Roman gods. And so Diocletian orders the army to worship the Roman gods. Well, there's a bunch of Christians in the military, predominantly because the previous emperor, Galenius, had been lax. But these Christians could not return to worshiping the Roman gods, and so they're forced out. Once the Christians are purged out of the military, Diocletian decides to use the military to force the entire Roman Empire to return to worshiping the Roman gods. And he has the worst persecution, systematically going province by province, arresting pastors, shutting down and tearing down churches, burning the scriptures, cutting out their tongues, boiling them alive. Whenever you have a purging of Christians out of the military, the next thing you can expect is for them to use the military to force their agenda.
It sounds like what's going on now. I just read an article this week that that's exactly what the Biden regime is doing. They're getting rid of Christians and conservatives out of the military. We know they're doing that, of course, but I'm hearing more and more reports of that this week.
Yeah, the next step is they're going to want to do war games against the American population. They're going to want to use the military to get ready to wage war on American citizens. Well, back to Nicholas. He is born in Asia Minor around 280 AD. Today, that's Turkey. And his parents are wealthy and elderly and die when a plague sweeps through town. And so he inherits a lot of money. Well, there's a movement forming at this time called monasticism, where if you really become a Christian, you're expected to give away all your money and join a monastery, so we'll never see you again. And so he decides he's going to do this. So he decides he wants to give away the money anonymously because he wants the credit to go to God and not to him. So you would sneak into the town at nighttime and throw money in the window of poor people. Supposedly, it would land in a shoe or a stocking that is drying by the fireplace. And one story became very well known. A merchant in the town of Patara had gone bankrupt. And back then, the creditors would not only come and take your house and lands, they would take your children. Mm. And this merchant had three beautiful daughters. He knew if they were taken, it would be a life of sex trafficking and prostitution. So the father, the merchant, had an idea. He thought if he could hurry up and marry his daughters off, the creditors couldn't take him. Unfortunately, he did not have money for a dowry, which was needed in that area of the world for a legally recognized wedding. Well, Nicholas, here's the problem. Late one night, throws money in the window that provides a dowry for the oldest daughter to get married, and then he does it on another night, a dowry for the second daughter, and when he does it for the third, by this time the dad is expecting it, and the dad is waiting up, and the dad runs outside, catches Nicholas, and Nicholas makes the father promise not to tell where the money came from because he wants the credit to go to God and not to him. So this is the origin of the tradition of secret gift giving on the anniversary of Nicholas's death, stockings by the fireplace, right, the midnight visits, and so forth. And it's also why St. Nicholas became the patron saint of pawnbrokers. You say, well, what did you say? Yeah, so the pawnbrokers say, we help families out in their time of financial need, and those early artwork of Nicholas has him pictured with three bags of gold or three gold balls symbolizing those three gold bags. So pawn shops will have three gold balls hanging out of their shop, right? Or on their little sign, symbolic of the three bags of gold that Nicholas threw in there. Believe it or not, that's a little bit of a stretch, but that's what they say. So Nicholas gives away all his money. He's going to join a monastery in the Holy Land, Mount Zion. And right before he does, the Lord tells him not to hide his light under a bushel. So he decides to go back to Myra, this port city in Asia Minor, and unbeknownst to him, the bishop of the town had died. And the church leaders couldn't decide who the next bishop was going to be, and one has a dream that the first person in the church would be named Nicholas. He was to be their bishop, and sure enough, Nicholas was the first one in the church. They ask his name. When he says Nicholas, they say, follow me, and he was not too thrilled with their telling him he was supposed to be their bishop, because the Roman Emperor Diocletian was arresting bishops and killing them. So it was sort of like, you be the bishop. No, 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 you first. No, really, I insist, you first, you be the bishop, right? And so anyway, he agrees, he becomes the bishop, and then he's thrown in jail. And he's awaiting death, and because Diocletian is torturing and killing him. Well, Diocletian is suddenly struck with an intestinal disease that so painfully abdicates the throne on May 1st, 305 AD. This was a big deal because the Roman emperors had been declaring themselves a god, sprinkling gold dust in their hair and demanding that their image be worshipped. So this was sort of like a god resigning. And the next emperor is Galerius. He continues the persecution of Christians. He's struck with an intestinal disease and dies in 311 AD. And the next emperor, it's a toss-up between four generals. Two are defeated. One is Maxentius in Rome, and the other is Constantine, who is stationed in York, Britain. Britain had been invaded by Julius Caesar in 45 BC, and now it's 311 AD. And so Constantine's men surround him and say, "Hail Caesar, we're behind you, go for it." Constantine marches toward Rome. And there's the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in 312 AD. The story is that Constantine saw the sign of Christ in the sky before the battle, and he puts it on all of his shields and symbols and wins. The sign of Christ was the first two Greek letters of the name for Christ. So we abbreviate states with two letters, while the Greeks would abbreviate names with two letters. And the first letter of the name Christ that makes the K sound is written as an X, and it is called Chi. And the letter that makes the R sound is called Rho, and it's written as a big P. And so the early Christian artwork would have the Chi Rho, the X and the P, and it was the name for symbolizing the name of Christ. And that is often pictured on 3rd century Christian artwork, this X and a P. Over the centuries, it got shortened just to the Chi, the X, and it was called the Christ's cross. And that's where you get the X hyphen M-A-S for Xmas. So it's not X crossing out Christ, it's X that stood for Christ. Oh. And it was called the Christ cross, or crisscross. And so it became a part of a oath. So I swear it fell through, cross my heart. What's the crossing the heart? That's the Christ cross, right? And so they would do it on documents. If you were going to swear that you were going to keep your word on a document, you would sign it the Christ's cross or sign it the X.
Oh, wow. Sign it the X.
And then they would kiss it to show sincerity. And so that came down to the X's and the O's on the bottom of a Valentine, right? You're swearing before Christ, you're going to keep your word. And anyway, so 313 AD, Constantine officially stops the persecution of Christians with the Edict of Milan. And now Nicholas is let out of jail. And so he goes back to Myra, that big port city, and he preaches against paganism. And nearby is the Temple to Diana. It's one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. 127 huge pillars and temple prostitutes. It was the Las Vegas of the Mediterranean. And the Apostle Paul preached there at Ephesus against Diana worship. And remember, the people all gathered together, great is Diana, the goddess of the Ephesians, right? And so Nicholas preaches against this so much that the people tear the temple down. And so no more temple to Diana. And then the Greeks were into sensual, you know, the body, and the word for gym, for gymnasium, means naked. And so gym was where a bunch of naked guys had spas and, you know, and all that. They ran the Olympics naked. And so Nicholas preached against this. The Romans also had exposure of unwanted infants. It was their version of abortion. And so in the Roman culture, the mother would bear the child and lay the child at the father's feet. If the father liked it and he picked it up, they would keep the baby. But if he didn't pick the baby up, the mother would have to place the child outside and expose it to the elements, and it would die. And so this is how Rome was started, right? There's two children, and they're putting outside and exposed to the elements, named Romulus and Remus, and a wolf comes by and nurses them, and they survive. But this is, we're all familiar with the stories of an older couple, and the door knocks, and they open it, and there's a baby in a basket. Who leaves a baby in a basket at the stranger's house? The Romans did. And so the Christians would collect these babies and raise them, and many became famous preachers. And so Nicholas preached against exposure of unwanted infants. He would have been a pro-life preacher against abortion today. And then you have the Arian heresy. So the first three centuries of Christianity, Christians do not live long enough to argue over doctrine. And I went to school in Rome and college, and we toured the catacombs and these little, you know, passageways and tunnels and rooms carved out of rock and first century Christian graffiti and candle marks on the ceiling. And that was the Christian experience. And you get caught and thrown to the lions. Well, Constantine legalizes Christianity, and now you have the first heresy. A guy named Arius said that Jesus was less than God. He was a created being, and he writes a catchy song. And the Visigoths, who were a tribe that came into Rome, converted en masse to Arianism. And so it begins to split the church. And not just the church, it splits the Roman Empire, since Constantine had made Christianity the de facto religion of the empire. And so now Constantine orders all the bishops and pays for them to come together to settle this doctrinal dispute. It's called the Council of Nicaea. They settle it, and they write the Nicene Creed. And when you see the 4th century Christian artwork of the Council of Nicaea, it'll have all the bishops sitting around, and Arius is thrown in a pit in the middle of the circle, right? And but the Greeks have that Nicholas was there at the Council of Nicaea, and he was so upset at Arius that he slapped Arius across the face at the floor of the conference. So jolly old Saint Nick had a little temper. You better watch out if he's coming to town. And so you see these early Christian artwork of Nicholas reaching over slapping Arius. I was searching the internet for these old pictures, and I found one, and it's got Nicholas, and underneath it says, I came to give presents to kids and to punch heretics. I just ran out of presents. And anyway, the Greeks have lots of stories about him. Some are more believable than others. A few is ships would leave North Africa filled full of grain, stop off at Myra on their way to Rome. But there was a famine, and people were starving. So Nicholas goes down to the dock and he talks some of the sailors into unloading bags of grain to feed his people. And they do, and Nicholas promises them that on their that God will bless them, and on their return trip, they said the grain that was left had multiplied, and they had more than enough. And so we have the Bible story of Elijah with the little widow and the meal barrel that didn't run dry, and sort of like that. And then Myra was a port city, and it was storming, and the fishermen and sailors couldn't get back, and Nicholas comes down to the dock and prays, and the sea becomes calm. And so this is why Nicholas, sort of like Jesus when he calmed the sea, so Nicholas also becomes the patron saint of sailors. And that comes into the story a little bit later. And Nicholas is often pictured holding a boat in artwork. And then you have a corrupt governor. And we're all familiar with corrupt governors. And this corrupt governor was going to kill some soldiers to cover up his corruption. Sort of a body count list that certain politicians have an unusual amount of people that die who have been associated with them. And so
and we all know who you're talking about here in the Mid-South.
So Nicholas has a dream where the Lord reveals to him the corrupt stuff the governor was doing. And so he goes down to the execution spot, breaks through the crowd, grabs the sword out of the executioner's hand and throws it down, and then in front of everybody tells all the details of the corrupt stuff the governor had been doing. The governor realizes nobody could know all the details other than God, and so he begs Nicholas to pray for him, that God would have mercy on his soul. Well, then we come up to Emperor Theodosius, 379 AD. He more or less outlaws paganism, so now you have a flood of new people into the church that really are more nominal than true believers. But he ends the Olympics, he ends temple prostitutes. This is Emperor Theodosius. And then we get up to Emperor Justinian, and he is the one who built the great Hagia Sophia Church in Constantinople. It's still there today that he's turned it into a mosque. Emperor Justinian is the one who built a big church to and named it after Nicholas. And it's in Myra, or today it's called Demre, Turkey. And now the Muslims have a part of Sharia law is if a Christian church falls into disrepair, the Christians cannot repair it. They just have to let it sort of crumble. And so the ruins of this church at Demre are still there, though. And then another piece of the puzzle, Eastern Europe celebrated Epiphany, the visit of the three wise men, when Jesus is revealed to the world on January 6th. But Western Europe celebrated December 25th, the birth of Christ, and they couldn't decide which day was holier. So at the Council of Tours, right, we're familiar with the Council of Nicaea, 325 AD, now this is the Council of Tours in 567 AD, they decide to make all 12 days between December 25th and January 6th
I never knew where the 12 days of Christmas came from. I've always wondered where did the 12 days come from. I'm 52 years old. I had to live 52 years to find that out finally. Holy cow.
Yeah, so it's not the 12 days leading up to Christmas. It's the 12 days between December 25th, January 6th. And they call them holy days. And over the centuries, holy days got pronounced holiday.
Hmm.
So when they say, well, don't say Merry Christmas, say Happy Holidays. Well, holidays is holy days. And what are the holy days but the 12 days of Christmas? Anyway, so then you have Russia. Vladimir the Great is the emperor, and he decides to throw the pagan gods in the Dnieper River and embrace monotheism. And so the Jews from a kingdom called the Khazars send ambassadors, but he doesn't convert. The Roman Catholics send ambassadors, he doesn't convert. Islam sends ambassadors. And the first court records of Vladimir says that Vladimir listened intently when the Muslim ambassadors told him that paradise was filled full of virgins because he was fond of women. But then when they told him he could no longer drink alcohol, Vladimir said, "We cannot have this religion because drink is the joy of the Ruses." So I think it's sort of interesting that Russia didn't convert to Islam because Vladimir liked to drink. Anyway, the Greeks send representatives, and they claim to have a corner on the market of Christianity. I mean, they speak Greek, the language of the New Testament. Their land is where John spoke and Paul spoke. All seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation are on their land. And some of the Russian ambassadors had gone to Constantinople, and they went into the Hagia Sophia church. It's 165 feet high, 102 foot across dome, 4 acres of gold mosaics. The ambassador said, "We felt like we were walking into heaven." And so Vladimir converts to Eastern Orthodox Christianity, and he adopts Nicholas as the patron saint of Russia. That's why about almost every town had a St. Nicholas church, and a lot of czars were named Tsar Nicholas.
Huh.
And then you have Islam, and they conquered the Mediterranean in 846 AD. 11,000 Muslims invaded Rome, and they trashed the Basilica of St. Peter's, and they trashed the bones of St. Peter. And then they trashed the church called St. Paul's outside the walls, and they trashed the bones of St. Paul. That was in 846 AD. And so now, as Pope Leo decided to build a 39-foot wall around the Vatican to keep these Muslim warriors out.
Wait a minute. Anyway, that's something you never hear about. The original walls went up to keep the Muslim jihadists out.
Yeah, it was Pope Leo that built them.
Wow.
And so now we're up to the year 1087, and all seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were wiped out by the Muslim Turks. And artwork, graves, everything's being trashed. And so the Christians want to move the graves of their famous Saint Nicholas over to Italy. And so they put them on a boat, and they get off in a little town called Bari, B-A-R-I, Bari, Italy. And there's a pope that dedicates a cathedral. The pope is Urban II. And the cathedral is still there with the remains of Nicholas. It's called Cathedrale Niccolo de Bari, Cathedral of Nicholas of Bari. And this pope, Urban II, has so many Greeks flooding over. And I mean, it would be like, you know, you're in Texas and Virginia is being taken over, and the Virginians bring the body of George Washington down to Texas. I mean, it was like, this is serious. And so Pope Urban II goes to the European kings at the Council of Clermont in 1095 AD and tells them they need to set aside their differences with the Greeks and send help. And they do. It is called the First Crusade. So the same pope that welcomes Nicholas's remains to Western Europe is the same pope that calls for the First Crusade. Now, there are about 10 major crusades in these two centuries, but Islam has had 14 centuries of crusades, and they're still going on today. Matter of fact, in 2009, the Turkish newspaper Hürriyet had an article, and it says, Turkish Cultural Tourism Minister Erdoğan Gurney told reporters in Antalya on Sunday that there were plans to demand the returns of the bones of St. Nicholas. Right, so they're acknowledging they used to be here, they were taken over to Italy, and we want them back. Well, now that St. Nicholas traditions are in Western Europe, they catch on. And the Italians like giving presents. And St. Francis decides, sort of in protest, to create the nativity scene, the creche scene. Saying all this gift-giving is fine, but we need to get back to the reason for the season. Jesus, the Son of God, was born in a manger. And so wherever you see a nativity scene, that goes back to St. Francis of Assisi in 1223. And then you have the Reformation. So you have the Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, 1529. He has 100,000 Muslims surrounding Vienna. Well, you have Martin Luther. He starts the Reformation in 1517. And by this time, there is a saint's day for every day of the year. Matter of fact, dozens of saints are recognized every single day. Churches are filled full of icons and relics and statues and graves. And Martin Luther considers all of this a distraction from Christ. So he cleans out the churches and he ends all the saints' days. But the Germans like their St. Nicholas Day, December 6th, with the gift giving. So Martin Luther decides to move all the gift giving to December 25th. And tells them that all gifts come from the Christ child. And the German pronunciation of Christ child is Christkindl. Like kindergarten, kindercare, kind means a child, and Christ means Christ. And so over the centuries, Christkindl got pronounced Kris Kringle.
Huh.
Right? So if you go to Germany, even to this day, they'll say, the Christkindl's coming, the Christkindl's coming, right? The Christ child. But they would, we call it Kris Kringle, but Kris Kringle's Kris Kindle, which means Christ shall. And now Martin Luther, he's credited with coming home at night. It's cold, the stars are twinkling, and he decides to put candles in the branches of the tree to tell his children, this is like the sky above Bethlehem when the Kris Kindle was born, the Christ child was born. Now, the tree has its own history. And if you know, St. Patrick went from Britain to Ireland in around 405 AD, and he confronted the Druids, these pagan tribes that had human sacrifice. And once they converted, Patrick used the three-leaf clover to teach the Trinity. Well, now we have the year 722 AD, another guy from Britain named Boniface, St. Boniface, also called Winfred. He leaves Britain and he goes through the forest to evangelize the Germanic tribes. Now, this 722, that's the same year that you had the Muslims invading France. And they're finally stopped in 732 by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours. But this is 722 AD, and St. Boniface, when he's also called Winfred, goes through the forest, and he comes upon this German tribe, and they worship Thor, who lives in a big oak tree. And so Thor is where we get the word Thursday or Thursday. And the Germans worshiped another god called Woden, and that's where you get Woden's Day or Wednesday. And so the Quakers would not pronounce Thursday, Wednesday, or Thursday because they're pagan gods. And so they would say Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, fourth day, and fifth day, and then Friday and Saturday. They wouldn't say Thursday and Woden. Anyway, so Thor lived in this big oak tree. They're about to do a sacrifice, either an animal or a human to it, sort of like the Druids had human sacrifice. And Boniface pulls out his axe, and he begins to chop down Thor's tree. And someone said, stop him. And someone else said, well, if Thor is really a god, he can protect his own tree. And he chops, St. Boniface chops the tree down. And then he wants to convert them, and he preaches the gospel, and he points at an evergreen tree. And he's trying to use something, they're all illiterate, use something that they can picture to symbolize the Trinity. And since the evergreen tree is in the shape of a triangle, he sort of uses that the same way that Patrick used the three-leaf clover. And so Henry Van Dyke is an English writer. In 1906, he wrote the first Christmas tree story. And he says, the day before Christmas in the year of our Lord, 722, it talks about Boniface chopping the oak tree down. But he points at an evergreen and says, not a drop of blood shall fall tonight, for tonight is the birth night of Christ, Son of the All-Father, Savior of the world. This little tree, the evergreen, is a young child of the forest. It shall be a home tree tonight. It is a wood of peace, for your houses are built of fir. It is a sign of endless life, for its branches are evergreen. It points toward heaven. Let this be called the tree of the Christ child, and gather about it not with bloody sacrifices, but with loving gifts of kindness. So in a town in Germany in this area around Geismar, there is a statue of St. Boniface standing on the stump of a oak tree holding a big axe, and in his other hand he's holding a little church symbolizing he brought. So the evergreen tree is symbolic of Germans converting to Christianity.
Wow.
And they would hang the tree in their house. So people that don't know this, they get mixed. Well, didn't they worship the tree? No, it was the Germans that worshiped the oak tree, and they worshiped Thor, and that was chopped down. And the evergreen tree is symbolic of them converting to Christianity and the Trinity. So over the years, they would hang the Christmas tree from the ceiling in their house. And so eventually it got turned around, so it went bottom up. But it was Martin Luther that decided to put the lights in the tree. Now, do some research, there's not a clear idea of where he gets the lights from, but it could be Hanukkah. Jews were in Germany, and the Jews this time of year would put the Hanukkah menorah in their windows. And so Martin Luther most likely would have seen those candles in the window. And now Hanukkah, what's that? So the Jews were taken captive to Babylon. Cyrus of Persia lets them go back and rebuild the temple. Persia is conquered by Alexander the Great. He dies and his four generals carve it up. And Seleucid, the general, takes Persia and the Holy Land. And he has a descendant named Antiochus Epiphanes, who who's this rotten, terrible guy that's making the Jews sacrifice pigs, stopping their circumcision, and trashing the temple. So the Jews get a guerrilla warfare called the Maccabees, and they drive Antiochus Epiphanes and his soldiers out. They clean out the temple, and they're going to relight the 7 menorah candlestick, the golden candlestick, but there's only enough oil for one day. They pour it in, it lasts 8 days. And so this is called the Feast of Dedication. And Jesus, the book of John, says Jesus was in Jerusalem for the Feast of Dedication and walking among Solomon's porch. And they came to him and said, if thou art the Christ, tell us plainly. And so, right, so Jesus is the light of the world. And it's the, when they have the lights of the Hanukkah. So Jews would put a 9-candle menorah in their windows. The middle one, the candle they would use to light the other 8, symbolizing the 8 days that this little flask of oil stayed, kept up burning. But this is Hanukkah. This is 165 BC when they started celebrating this. So certainly there's a chance that Martin Luther would have seen the candles and came up with the idea of putting the candles in the branches of the evergreen tree. And but there's one more part of the story, and that's Henry VIII. And this gets it a little bit closer to home. Do I have enough time to tell this story? So Martin Luther brings the Reformation to Germany. Henry VIII brings the Reformation to England, but not because of a spiritual experience. He just wanted another wife. And he ends the saints' days, including the popular St. Nicholas. He moves all the gift-giving to December 25th, but he brings back an old Roman holiday, Saturnalia. You have to remember, Britain used to be a Roman colony from Julius Caesar, 45 BC. And so during Henry VIII's time, Christmas became a party time, drinking, carousing, wassailing, which you take a drink of booze and throw the rest of it on some plant for a nice harvest the next year, and, you know, playing games and chasing women and all this kind of revelry. If you saw The Christmas Carol with Charles Dickens, there's the spirit of Christmas present. He's a big fat guy with robes on, wreath in his hair, goblet of wine, grapes all around, the ho-ho happy party guy. And you're looking at him asking yourself, who is this guy? He sort of looks like Santa, but he also sort of looks like some Roman god. Well, it was Saturn, but they Christianized him and called him Father Christmas. They couldn't call him St. Nicholas because saints were outlawed after the Reformation. And so during this time, with all this drinking and partying, the Puritans come along. And the Puritans don't like Christmas. They are really, really strict. Matter of fact, the Puritans are so strict that they forbade Shakespeare from mentioning God in his plays. They considered it taking God's name in vain and casting pearls before swine. They have this den of iniquity of a bunch of drunk, lewd people out there, and you're mentioning God's holy name. And so this is when William Shakespeare writes his Midsummer Night's Dream with little fairies and so forth. I'd give you an example. Cotton Mather was a Puritan leader, and he said, can you in your conscience think that our holy Savior is honored by mad mirth, long eating, hard drinking, lewd gaming, and rude revelry fit by for a Saturn or a Bacchus or a Mohammedan Ramadan? Certainly the birth of our Savior, for which we owe high praises, we take time to please the hellish legions to do actions that have much more of hell than of heaven in them. And so this was the attitude. And so the Puritans shut Shakespeare's Globe Theater down. And finally, in 1644, the Puritans tore Shakespeare's Globe Theater down. So these Puritans were strict, and this is the time that America gets settled. So the Pilgrims come across, and the captain of the Mayflower is named Christopher Jones. He writes in his ship's log, December 25th, 1620, but at anchor Plymouth Harbor, but Christmas Day, but not observed by these colonists, they being opposed to All Saints' Days, etc. Now, William Bradford, governor of the Pilgrims, writes that a second boatload of Pilgrims came over, and they wanted to celebrate Christmas. So he says, one more incident rather amusing. On Christmas Day, the governor called the people to work as usual, right? The Pilgrims' idea was that every day is the same, except the Sabbath is the holy day. And he says, but most of the new company excused themselves, said it went against their conscience to work on that day. So the governor told them that if they made it a matter of conscience, he would spare them till they became better informed. So he went with the rest and left them, but upon returning from work at noon, he found them at play in the streets, some pitching the bar, some at stool ball, and such like sports. So the governor went to them, took away their games, and told them that it was against his conscience that they should play in others' work. If they made keeping the day a matter of devotion, let him remain in their houses, but let there be no gaming and reveling in the streets. Matter of fact, the Puritans were so strict, they had a 5-shilling fine for anybody caught celebrating Christmas. So the Pilgrims, Puritans, and most Presbyterians did not celebrate Christmas. But the Germans and French and Anglicans and the Dutch did. And most of our Christmas traditions come from the Dutch. And so the Dutch pronunciation of St. Nicholas was Sant Niklaus or Santa Claus. And we're all familiar with a Catholic saying, St. Peter's at the gates of heaven. Well, the Dutch do a take on the book of Revelation, where Jesus will return at the end of the world to judge the living and the dead, riding a white horse. And the saints will come back with him, riding white horses. And St. Nicholas is a saint, so he'll be one of those riding a white horse. But he's such a special saint, he gets to come back once a year for a little mini-judgment, a little checkup on the kids, make sure they're on the right track, see who's naughty, see who's nice. And so to this day, in Holland, they have St. Nicholas coming once a year, dressed as a bishop, riding a white horse to check up on the kids. But over the years, saints come from where? Heaven, the celestial city, the New Jerusalem, that turned into the North Pole. And the angels kept the Lamb's Book of Life and Book of Works, that turns into the elves keeping the Book of the Naughty and the Nice. And then you have countries like Norway and Finland where they didn't have many horses, and so they have Santa Claus coming on reindeer. And then he has with him a helper named Zwarte Piet, and he is a Muslim. And we have to remember that the Muslims controlled Spain for 700 years and carried away over 1 million Europeans into slavery. And there were entire Catholic orders in the Middle Ages called the Trinitarians. Head of the order was called the Ransomer, and they would collect alms and donations to rescue your friend. And so they would tell the little kids, if you're good, St. Nicholas gives you a present. If you're naughty, his little helper, Zwarte Piet, will put you in a gunny sack, take you back to Spain, and sell you into Muslim slavery. And I was doing a radio interview, and somebody called in and said, yeah, I was raised in Holland, and in our neighborhood, all the little boys would go to sleep with pocket knives in our pockets the night before Santa Claus visited so we could cut ourselves out of the gunny sack. Anyway, so you have Holland. Now, remember, St. Nicholas was the patron saint of sailors. The Dutch had a worldwide global fleet of merchant military ships, and instead of a Poseidon or a mermaid, they had a St. Nicholas on the front of the ship. And they settled New Amsterdam, which became New York. So the first Dutch Reformed Church in New York is the St. Nicholas Dutch Reformed Church, founded in 1642. It went on to become the largest Protestant church in America. And Teddy Roosevelt went there. He was Dutch Reformed. And they built this cathedral at the corner of 48th Street and 5th Avenue. But as the years went on, it became a financial district. And Sinclair Oil went to the elders and says, we'll pay you a lot of money for this corner. And they tore the church down, and then they went and built the Marble Collegian Church, where Norman Vincent Peale was the pastor, and famous people, even Donald Trump went there. But no more big cathedral in downtown. So we have New York, a couple more pieces of the puzzle. Washington Irving, he's the one who gave us Rip Van Winkle, Legend of Sleepy Hollow. He wrote Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York. Knickerbocker's a made-up name, but it stuck, and that's why he got the New York Knicks basketball. And Washington Irving gave us Gotham for Gotham City. But in there, he says St. Nicholas comes once a year, riding in his wagon over the treetops, dropping presents down the chimney. But he describes St. Nicholas dressed in a typical Dutch outfit rather than a bishop's outfit, of a stocking hat, long trunk hose, you know, large boots, you know, pipe, and so forth. And then in New York, you have Clement Moore. He's a Hebrew professor at an Anglican seminary. His family donated the land for the seminary. There is a park in downtown New York at the corner of 10th Avenue and 22nd Street called the Clement Moore Park. And so he writes a poem for his children. It's a visit from St. Nicholas. And you know it. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there. So he's still a saint, but now he's shrunk. He's a right jolly plump old elf. I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself, right? And then you have the middle 1800s Civil War. Illustrator Thomas Nast, N-A-S-T, for Harper's Weekly magazine. He's the one that gave us the Republican elephant and the Democrat mule. And so Thomas Nast does a cover illustration of St. Nicholas talking to Union troops and little boys playing with toys. But in the background, there's a North Pole sign, which was actually a political jab at the South to say that St. Nicholas belongs to the North. And then the last piece is Haddon Sunblum, an artist who gave us the Quaker Oats Man and Aunt Jemima Syrup. And he does, for Coca-Cola, a painting every year for 30 years of St. Nicholas, Santa Claus, drinking Coke. And since Coca-Cola pioneered mass marketing, this is the image that was spread around the world. He's no longer an elf. He's full grown again. He's a nice, huggable grandfather, rosy cheeks, ruddy complexion, full of toys. But if we go back to the beginning, there really was a man who lived in Asia Minor named Nicholas, who wanted to go into the ministry, right? He became a bishop. He was imprisoned by a corrupt government for his Christian faith. And he preached against sexual immorality of Diana worship. And he stood up for the Trinity, Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. And he confronted corrupt politicians. But most of all, we remember him because he was generous and gave to the poor, but he wanted to do it anonymously so the credit would go to God and not to him. So it's a fascinating story. It's all in the book. There really is a Santa Claus, the history of St. Nicholas and Christmas holiday traditions. And AmericanMinute.com is my website.
That is fascinating. And I've done my best to sit here with my laptop and keep up with you, my friend. Fascinating. And you've done it all within 8:59. Amazing. Logan, we need to replay this several times on Christmas Eve and on Christmas Day. Don't you think, Logan? Yeah, I think we do. I just dropped my microphone, but I guess you can hear me. I definitely think that's what we need to do. Excellent, excellent. Bill, they can get this whole story at AmericanMinute.com, correct? No, AmericanMinute.com. Yep, AmericanMinute.com. There it is right there. Were you going to say something?
Well, there's lots more in the book. I mean, they go through how Christmas went on to become the most important day in Western civilization, with lots of kings being crowned and baptized on Christmas Day. Charlemagne, William the Conqueror. I go through the Battle of Trenton, where George Washington crosses the Delaware River on Christmas Eve. Even 1968, Apollo 8 is circling the moon on Christmas Eve, and the astronauts Frank Borman give a Christmas blessing to Earth. But one of the famous quotes is Clarence Mannion is the dean of Notre Dame Law School, and he talks about the calendar changing from B.C. to A.D., and he says Christmas Day is the great divide for the timing and recording of all people, things, and events that have ever taken place on Earth, the one place in the long, long trail of time where the magnetic needle of history stands vertical and points up.
Wow. Right?
So we switch from B.C. to A.D. on what? Christmas Day. Now, it was maybe be off 4 years, but nevertheless, that's the purpose of it, to go back to date to the birth of Christ.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Love it, love it, love it. Thank you so much, Bill. AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. They can get the book there. It's an excellent little book. I'm going to go back and show the cover one more time here, Lord. You have so many slides in here. I mean, we are just blowing through it. But there's the cover of the book right there. If Logan wants to show it again, AmericanMinute.com. There really is a Santa Claus, a history of St. Nicholas and Christmas holiday traditions. Our friend William J. Federer, who's been a friend of mine for probably close to 25 years now, Bill. Can you believe that?
Yeah, back when I had more hair.
Well, that's
but you're looking great.
That's true for all of us, though, Bill. And you're a great friend. Thank you so much for all you do and for your commitment to always working in the gospel when you're with us as well. We appreciate that. Merry Christmas to you and your family. Look forward to working with you a lot in 2022, my friend.
Well, thank you, and Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Thank you. Bill Federer checking in, AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com.